Hello, 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 and welcome to the My Empty Hands podcast. I am Reggie Darden, as usual, where we typically talk about Kenpo and the martial arts. And today we're gonna deviate a little bit, and I've got a very special guest here that was highly recommended by Mr. Lee Wedlake. So I'm excited to be speaking with Mr. Charles Johnson today, and yeah, we're gonna talk some fencing today. So he is a great fencing coach, and I don't know much about fencing, so I'm excited to hear his story and learn something about fencing. And also, of course, I'm gonna have to get his thoughts on the sword fighting scene in The Princess Bride. I'm sure you probably get asked about that at any time, but we'll definitely have to get into that. But yeah, I'm really excited to have you on and hear your story. So.
Well, I Reggie, I appreciate the opportunity to be here. I've been doing fencing for a long time, and it's just another martial art. Actually, there's some similarities to your Eastern Asian style martial arts. Instead of blocking with their hands or our feet, we simply block with their weapons. And there's three different types of weapons that are fenced, all in Olympic competition. There's foil, which has a limited target area to the upper torso. There's épée, which is the closest to the actual dueling weapon, and it's the whole body, anywhere you hit, head, toe, anywhere you can score. And then there's saber, which is the upper torso, including the head and the arms. And you can score anywhere on the loose parts of the body. So, yeah, and it is an Olympic sport. The karate's in the Olympics now, right?
My understanding is it's, I guess, not completely officially in. It's kind of like a trial. They've been kind of trying it out. So I don't think it's a, every year sort of thing just yet. But
Well, that's too bad. They should include it. I mean, they're talking about including some other things. They're talking, somewhere I heard that they were talking about including a lightsaber. And I'm like, what?
yeah, the world is definitely changing, which although I have seen some pretty impressive I've seen a few little clips here and there on YouTube of some different things of that ilk, and it's actually pretty impressive. So
Yeah, I'll have to check out the lightsaber. I can't imagine how they're going to score them.
Yeah, I think that's some would argue that's kind of the problem with Olympic taekwondo, Olympic karate, and even I guess there's some talk about including like jiu-jitsu. Judo is already Olympic, but just trying to take these arts and put kind of a rule set and a scoring system that's fair and correct and accurate seems to be kind of difficult while still trying to, I guess, remain the purity of the art in the case with like Olympic Taekwondo there at least in my experience there's not a lot of fans of Olympic Taekwondo these days in comparison to a traditional Taekwondo, just because
Interesting.
there's a lot of techniques and things that you don't do in Olympic Taekwondo that's part of the normal Taekwondo, like punching to the head or really punching at all in Olympic Taekwondo that doesn't seem to happen much anymore. And I know a lot of the Taekwondo diehards are not big fans of that, so I don't know. We'll see. It's kind of hard to get everybody in the same room and agree to all the same things. So.
Well, it sounds like fencing 100 years ago when the Olympics first came, when the modern Olympics evolved. They were, every country had its own set of rules on fencing. And so they had to get together and decide on what would be, you know, the best course of action, what would be the fairest scoring system for it. And they finally did come up with a scoring system. So when the first Olympics was introduced, I think it was in 1898, the actual rules for all three weapons, they still were fencing all, they were fencing all three weapons, foil, epee, and saber. Although saber back then was actually called broadsword. Mm-hmm. That's another story. But it took me a while to figure out, when I was reading about that, it took me a while to figure out broadsword. Were they actually using, you know, double-edged 3-pound broadswords? But it turned out it was actually the saber. The saber hasn't changed that much. That we use in competition hasn't changed that much over the years. The rule three weapons fit on 1 8.5 by 11 page. And more of the international rules, it's a book.
Yeah, things grow as trial and error and all these different kind of rules come up, and things expand quite a bit over time. So,
oh yeah, and it's probably the same thing. I mean, let me ask you a question: from one country to another, say Taekwondo in China and Taekwondo in America, are the rules a bit different from one to the other?
I would assume so. I wouldn't think that there's a huge difference, but I would think that it probably depends on the organization. As far as I know, in the Taekwondo world, there are kind of the major corporation organizations, and so. Like in the bigger organizations, I would assume that they have kind of the same rules. But then, as you move to like a smaller organization, they may be more lenient on certain things or more strict. I guess it kind of depends on the lineage that they follow. Kind of in comparison to. Like Kenpo schools, just looking at Kenpo schools in the United States, there's a lot of different organizations just because, you know, the people in charge don't all see eye to eye on, on or what the rules should be. There's a pretty famous Kenpo joke, about how many Kenpo people does it take to change a light bulb, and the number varies, but you could say 100, 1 to change the light bulb, and 99 to say that well, that's not the way Ed Parker told me how to do it. So
that's very similar in fencing. You have the same problem. It's an interpretation of the rules. I tell in foil and saber, well, in all three weapons, you have a director. He is the, he used to be called the president of the jury because he used to have women as dry. Now it's electric, and I'll explain that in a minute. The director calls the action and stops the action if he sees a score or if he sees some dangerous action happening or if there's an off target that occurs. Well, that'll stop the action, and then you start again from where the off target occurred. I tell my students, because foil and saber have something called right of way. Epee doesn't. Epee is probably the purest of all three weapons. If both of you hit, you both get a touch. And that goes back to when they were actually fencing epee. The epee was actually the last dueling weapon. So when they were fencing epee to actually try to inflict pain on each other, if you both hit, the guy who was directing the action then would call a halt, and you your personal position would come out on the field, and he would bandage you up, and you'd go again. Because in epee, there could only be one. And it was always, epee was supposed to be the first blood. Well, if you both drew blood at the same time, it didn't count. So it was still pretty dangerous to duel with that. And epee being the last dueling weapon, people were really trying to settle more of a matter of honor at that point in time than they were to try to actually end the other person's life. So epee being the purest, you know, you can have a double touch. You both get a point. There's nothing called right of way. Now, in foil and saber, you have right of way. Because it's based on the dueling, if I was in a real duel and I was being attacked, I would have to defend. I would be obligated to defend if I tried to attack into my opponent's attack. Chances are, we both would be injured or we both would be killed if it was a real duel. So, following that, the rules for modern fencing in epee and saber are the person who attacks has the right of way or the right to attack. That's usually established by the person who's moving forward and threatening his opponent in some manner. So the person being threatened is obligated to defend, and they defend with what's called a parry. And that's the same thing as when you guys in Kempo block with your hand, okay? Instead of blocking with a hand, we simply block with a blade, and we're only, you know, we can't use the other hand. The left hand has to stay behind you. In foil and saber, if you bring it forward, you're covering the target area. And so you can get a penalty card for that. So the right of way is really hard to for most people to understand unless they've seen fencing for a while. And I try to tell, over the years, I tried to tell my students that it's a lot like the Supreme Court. It's subject, the law, the rule, is subject to interpretation. So it's a very subjective thing that happens in foil and saber. You have to learn to fence not only to outwit, outsmart your opponent, but you also are fencing in a way that the director will understand your actions. So you have to try to fence clearly so that your actions are clear enough that he can make the call you want him to make. And that's not always easy.
Gotcha.
It just confuse you thoroughly, or?
No. It makes sense. I'm also looking at kind of a little article that kind of gives us the summary, so I can kind of get a little visual picture of some of this as well. So it makes sense to me.
What happens about foil or saber is usually in foil and saber, epee is different in the strategy. In foil and saber, usually the person who has the advantage is the person who attacks. So you're at your on guard lines. The strip, you have a strip that's 70, it's 14 meters long. The strip you fence on by about 3 meters wide. And 2.5 to 3 meters wide, and you have your on guard lines, and you start at the on guard lines, and the director will say on guard ready, and you will say, you will indicate you're ready, and then he will say fence. Well, usually in foil and saber, the person who takes the action first, who comes out quicker than his opponent, is the person who's really not only going to have the right of way, but that's the person who's going to have the advantage. Because in that person's mind, he's developed some kind of strategy on what he wants to do with his opponent. And his opponent doesn't know what the other person's thinking. He has to sort of figure it out. So he has to give himself time to figure out where the attack's going and what kind of attack is going to be made. So the person out of the gate first in Foreland Saber really does have the advantage of the person being attacked. So you kind of want to be the first person off the line.
Yeah, very very similar to karate point sparring that sort of thing.
He knows he should have. Hopefully, he's not just fighting blind. He should have some idea of what they want to do. We usually tell our students, when you're at the on guard line, your tactics should be, you don't want to develop a strategy or tactics that are so involved and complex that halfway through the action, you forget what it was you originally wanted to do. You want to keep it simple. So, but you do want to have several ideas at the on guard line of what you might be able to do with this particular opponent. So it helps if you have fenced this person before and in some prior thing or in some prior event or that you've been able to at least watch this person fence so you can figure out what your strategy against them is going to be. The strategy in fencing is pretty simple. And it's probably the same thing in karate. You can tell me. To me, and there's probably coaches out there who would say, oh, no, that's all wrong. But to me, strategy in fencing is very simple. You're either going to be on the offense, the defense, or a combination of the both. And it depends on who you're fencing. So I don't know how that applies for karate, whether, it's that simple or not. But.
Well, it's very, very similar. I mean, you can go to tournaments and things and watch the fighters you can kind of learn everybody has their style and to kind of see the lineage or of a particular instructor or a particular organization, the students, even though everybody has their own spin, can kind of still see the foundation, I guess, that they kind of come from those little building blocks. And you can develop a strategy on that.
It helps in both. It's going to help if you know your opponent, if you've seen them fence before. If not, at least in fencing, you go out there and you make some feinting actions, some false actions to try to draw them to see how they're going to react. And that's the other thing in fencing is sometimes, especially with newbies, they want to go 100 miles an hour all the time. And that's the hardest thing in the world to get them to stop because they think it's all about speed. Well, it really isn't. If you're going too fast, you can't see what your opponent's doing. And, I come out and I make a direct attack to my opponent's number four position, which is kind of to the right of his on guard, to the right of his sword arm. Or I'm sorry, to the left of his sword arm. And I make that direct attack. If I don't know some idea of how he fences, then, he could step back and he can block me and hit me on the repose. So I make the attack. He steps back. He parries, blocks. Now he has the right of way because he successfully removed the threat by blocking my blade. Now he goes forward and he makes the touch. So I need to have some idea of, is he going to do that? So I might come out and make a false attack. If I don't know this person, I'm going to come out and make a false attack, see what they do, how they react to that direct attack to four. And then now I come back and I know, okay, I go four, he's going to parry four because he's got options. He can do different types of blocks. I can come out, I go direct at four, and he goes to block four with a parry four. I disengage around it, and I hit him in some other part of the target. So, if you don't know your opponent, you have to kind of feel them out. You can't make really rushed attacks. Got to see what they're doing to know what you should do.
Really? Yeah, that very, very much sounds like it is in Kenpo. Kenpoists are known for having this very fast hands. And when you see demonstrations, it's very exciting because they're moving so fast. But just moving fast is not enough. Applying the techniques and the principles of motion and those fine details are what's going to you know, keep you alive in the street and get you winning in the tournaments and such. And kind of people on the outside are don't really understand that aspect, and doesn't get until you actually get into the training that you start seeing, oh, wait a second, this little movement or this positioning of my feet or my hands or any of my body parts, and this way of thinking is more in depth than just moving really fast. So yeah, there's definitely similarities.
Oh yeah, there is. Between European martial arts and Asian style martial arts, there's a lot of similarities. As a matter of fact, I think you probably are familiar with a gentleman named Bruce Lee. He fits for a little bit with his brother, and his style of karate was some of the moves he does are very similar to what you do in fencing.
Yeah.
When he does that thrust, when he's pushing off his back leg and hitting with his fist, that's definitely that's the same thing as the lunge we do in fencing to try to drive the point into the target area.
Exactly. Yeah, and the you can. That's one of the great things about Bruce Lee. You can see that DNA of all these different systems and principles in his movements and in the things that he was doing, and he was constantly evolving and changing, much like Kenpo. And a lot would argue that Ed Parker and Kenpo had a lot of influence on Bruce Lee, and you can see a lot of that in his movements and a lot of the principles and things that he adhered to or and tried to teach or exist in Kenpo as well. So
yeah, I think he took a little bit here and a little bit there to kind of come up with his own style and way of doing things. Well, that's sort of what I've tried to do over the years, because there are, just like in karate, there are certain styles. There's the way the Italians fence. There's the way the Germans fence. There's the way, and there's certain schools have fought in Germany, the way the Italians fence, the way the French fence, and the way the British fence. So there's all these different schools. And I've been asked before, what style do you use? And I'm like, well, it's kind of an eclectic mixture of everything, because I can see something in one style that works, but something else in that style that doesn't seem to work as well. So I've learned over the years, and I've been doing this now for 40 years. I've learned over the years to watch other coaches, to watch other fencers, and where they're, and kind of develop what we do at our club based on all sorts of different actions and things that people do or that coaches do, and not just try to adhere to one. The Italians used to, I don't know if they still do, but they used to. It was stand your ground, parry, riposte, parry, riposte, parry, riposte. In other words, block, hit, or block, and try to hit, block, try to hit, block, try to hit. And the French, it was always avoid. So, you know, the French were like, let's not make a lot of blade contact. Let's try to do this the easiest way possible. I make the attack. My opponent tries to block. I disengage around their block and then finish the action. That might require one or two disengages. But yeah, I've tried to not particularly have any one style. A friend of mine was Matt Garrett, and he passed away a number of years ago, but he was a great coach. He was coach at the University of Illinois for a while, and then he was the head coach at Penn State for a long time. And Matt told me one time, he said, you know, kind of let your students develop their own style. And so I teach them what I think works and what will help them. But then if they start doing things and they do them a little differently and it works for them, I'm certainly not going to go, well, no, you can't do it that way. I want them to be successful. So, you know, I try to allow them to develop their own style. And I think that works better than trying to produce a bunch of cookie cutter fencers. If they all felt the same way, then every coach is going to know how to beat them.
So I'm curious, in many of the martial arts world, there's the back and forth about, oh, well, this teacher taught this way, or this isn't traditional. Is there that kind of a division and I dare to say a drama in the fencing world about, is there a particular pioneer that had one way of doing it, and there's a debate about, oh, well, this is the way we should be doing fencing, or is there?
Well, I don't know about, tradition in fencing because it changes. It's constantly changes because the rules. We were talking earlier about difference in rules from one place to another, and in international competition, the rules are a little bit different than what we fence here in national championships or North American Cup events. So there's a little bit of, play there, but generally speaking, fencing is constantly, it's really constantly evolving. And I think that has to do with one coach will watch another coach and he'll see something his students are doing that it really works. And so he'll adopt that in his cell. And so I don't think there's really much that I think it, maybe in the past there probably was a lot of argument about, well, our style's better than your style, this, that, and the other thing, or you're not following the traditions properly. But fencing really is constantly evolving, and it's evolved now to the point where if you watch any of the Olympic fencing, it's really become super fast, and it's become a lot about speed. And it used to be more about. As a matter of fact, years ago, before electric scoring, and I'll explain this electric scoring stuff here in a minute. Years ago, when they were fencing what we call dry, no electric scoring boxes or anything, they used to give points for style, for how good you looked when you were doing it. That's all gone by the way now. They don't care how you look as long as you make the touch. And that had a lot to do with when the electric fencing evolved. And the first weapon they were able to electrify was the épée, because there's no limitation on target. You can hit anywhere, as I explained earlier, head, foot, toe, doesn't matter, hand. Matter of fact, because hand generally is close to target, you used to see a lot of attacks in the hand. Oh, excuse me. That some of that's gone away too. Now you see a lot more attacks to the body in épée. But I lost my train of thought. Has that ever happened to you?
All the time.
All the time.
You're talking about with the electric
Exactly.
scoring.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So the épée, because the whole body was targeted, it was easy. It was pretty simple to make it. So. They could you could score anywhere you hit, so it didn't matter about having any kind of specialized equipment or covering on the body to allow it to score. Then they and so what it is you have a box that has a red light, a green light, and in the case of épée, there's no off targets because the whole body's target, so anywhere you hit. One opponent hits and this red light goes off, they get a touch. Green light goes off, that person gets the touch. They both hit, they both get the touch in épée. In foil, it became a lot more complicated in foil because foil, both these épée and foil are both point weapons. You have to get with the tip. So you've got a spring-loaded tip and a wire that runs from the tip down through a groove in the blade. And it goes to a socket, and you plug into that socket because you have a body wire that runs out the sleeve of your jacket and down the back of the jacket, and that plugs into a reel. It's a lot like a dog reel, so that when you move back and forth, the wire moves with you. And then that ringle is connected by another set of wires to the scoring box. So when you hit in that tip, he presses it, it sets the lights off on the box. And like I said, that thing is simple. But then when they got to foil and trying to figure out how to score foil, they had to have some means of limiting the target, the scoring area, to the upper torso. So what they did was they came up with the thing has two wires guarding down the thing. They came up with a one-wire system. So you got one wire running down the groove to the socket. And what happens, and you have a very lightweight metallic jacket you wear over your protective clothing. And so when the TIF hits that metallic jacket, it grounds out. And so I'm not sure how it sets up the circuitry in the scoring box. But it grounds out when it hits that metallic jacket, and that sets the lights off. And because you have off targets, you can only score on that metal jacket that you're wearing. That metal, it's like a vest. It's a metal vest. It's called a lame. You can only score on that. You have off targets, the arms, the head, the legs, feet, anywhere you hit elsewhere, it's going to have a white light that goes off of the box. And that indicates to the director that it was an off-target hit, bout stops, they start again from that same point where it stopped. When they score, then go back to the on-guard lines and they start again. Then when they got the saber, saber was the last weapon to be electrified, and it took a while to figure out how to do that. They used to have something called a capture, which was a really terrible way to try to make the saber work for this purpose. Saber is a cutting weapon. It's based on the cavalry saber that became popular during the Napoleonic Wars. It was a really good movie, and now I can't remember the name of it. It had a lot of that. It was about the Napoleon era, and there was a lot of saber fighting in it. It was a really good choreography. I just don't remember the name of it. At any rate, saber, when you hit with the edge of the blade, you have to have some way for to ground that out. They used to have something called a capteur, which, like I said, was a really lousy way to score because the capteurs were terrible. A capteur is just what it means. It captures the signal. So it was a little spring-loaded. It was a steel ball or spring, and it was mounted in the guard, the bell guard of the weapon. And when you hit with the edge of the blade, it would cause that little capteur, that ball, to compress that spring and make contact, and it would cause the scoring box to go off. You had to hit pretty hard to make it work. And half the time, if the spring was weak, it would score when it really shouldn't have scored. And so it was just a mess. Then somebody came up with a brilliant idea that all they really needed to do was to cross the wires across the socket so that both sides of the socket were hooked up at the same time. Now, when you score, you're making a complete circuit with the blade on the metallic jacket, and the light goes off. So it became much simpler. But that was the last weapon that they were able to electrify. And it's really kind of, I know trying to explain it and not see it is kind of confusing to understand it. I would recommend to anybody who's interested in it, fencing, you know, go to YouTube or go and try to find some of the Olympic fencing. And you can see the different types of weapons and how they're used.
Well, yeah, for sure. I'm gonna definitely check that out. I'm curious. So, in the Taekwondo world, the electronic scoring is a big problem. In fencing, is it kind of any better, or is it still? They're still trying to figure it out?
Well, they pretty well got it figured out, but you can still have light with any electronic, as you well know from a few minutes ago. Yeah. Any electronic can have, you know, can create a problem. The weapons, the point weapons, for an apode, they're only of the spring that's inside that tip that compresses. Can only have so much weight. So they check it when you come up to the on guard line, you will present your weapon to the director, and he will put a weight on it. It's heavier for the FA, it's lighter for the foil. I forget how many kilograms or whatever, or not kilograms, but how many ounces of that weight is. It's very light. But the spring has to be strong enough that the weight will not push the tip down and cause the box to go off. So everybody's weapon has to be equal. There can't be one person have a lighter spring than another because that gives them an advantage. So, you know, there are certain things, certain technicalities, and I'm sure in the beginning when they first started using electric, it took them a while to figure out, well, you know, this guy's scoring all the time. How come? Well, his spring was probably lighter. So it didn't take as much thrust to push it in. And you also have things like your reels, your take-up reels. The reels that go from, that's you're hooked in or wired into that reel with your body cord, and that goes back. And those reels are moving back and forth constantly. The reels can break down and have to be replaced in the middle. I've seen it happen a lot of times in the middle of battles and things. So you have at any national, international event, you're going to have something called an armorer. And this is going to be his responsibility to try to keep all of that equipment running. And when you get to a national championships where you might have 20, 25, 30 strips running at one time, those armorers are running around all over the place like chickens with their head cut off, trying to keep all that stuff working. So, yeah, there's all sorts of technical problems. I didn't know Taekwondo, that they score electronically?
For the Olympic style, yeah, they have electronic electronic sensor things that, from my understanding, don't work very well. And
I'll listen, shake. I haven't watched any of the Olympic Taekwondo, but I'll have to check that out.
Yeah, it's changed quite a bit from kind of the traditional side of it. It's probably a very different beast now. They're very two separate things now. I think most Taekwondo people would not put them in the same category. And there's Olympic Taekwondo, and then there's traditional Taekwondo. it's pretty fun.
Yeah, I can understand. The Olympics people, they want everything to be quick, exciting for the viewing audience. You know, and you can think when the Asian, when TV became very popular back in the 50s and everything, that started changing the Olympics. That started changing sports altogether, I think. They want things to be, in fencing, they tried, we've always been called the invisible sport because you have this wire mesh mask you wear, and you can't see a person's face behind that wire mesh. But you know, I definitely wouldn't fence without one. Otherwise, I'd be running around with an eye patch. So we were always called the invisible sport. They tried to fix that by requiring that you had the name for EPA. You had to have it on the back of your jacket. We wear this. A lot of protective gear. I'll explain that in a little bit too, because that's really important. You have the name on the back of your jacket because you wouldn't be wearing any of the metal vests or anything for saber or foil. And then in foil, they required you have it on the back of your lame so that they could see who you were. They still require that. But then for a while, the TV networks persuaded on that, well, we need to have a clear view of a person's face, so we can see them on TV. So they tried to introduce a mask. Instead of having the protective wire mesh, the mask would have a clear Lexan plastic face piece, so you can see the person. And, you know, as far as protection goes, Lexan's bulletproof, so it's good protection. Problem was, it gets scratched up. You're facing saber and you're getting head cuts. You're getting somebody slicing through your head all the time. And those Lexan masks would get all scratched up in no time. in foil, if somebody missed and happened to hit you in the mask, it would do the same thing. The other thing was you feel open, unprotected with that clear base plate. And so sometimes you'd see people flinch. Here comes the attack. They freeze because they didn't feel like they were protected at all by that Lexan, but they were. You know, Lexan's, you know, it's good armor, but, you know, they didn't work out too well. They did away with that. And then I think in 2000, let's see, 2020, was it 2020 or one before? At any rate, in one of the more modern, newer Olympics, they did they put the scoring rights on top of the helmets, which made the helmet, you know, the light would go off and they, my helmet's red, the other person's green. And so you could really easily, clearly see who was scoring and everything, but that made the helmets really unwieldy. And so I noticed in the last Olympics, they didn't do that. They'd done away with that. So they're constantly trying to do things to make it more friendly to the audience, because fencing has never been really, it's never been a really high, you don't get a big audience for fencing usually. Although the Paris Olympics, we did. It was kind of amazing. The stands were absolutely completely filled in Paris for the Olympics, which was good. And we won medals. We actually, the U.S. never used to win medals in the Olympics. And in international competition, we seldom ever got into the bronze medal, even the bronze medal round. Sometimes we did, but very seldom. And so in the last, I don't know, since 2004, we've been taking gold in one weapon, in this weapons, sometimes gold in team, silvers in team, bronze and silver. In 2020, we took, Lee Kiefer took gold in foil, in women's foil, and then Lee Kiefer took gold in women's foil again in 2024. So, as a matter of fact, we took gold and silver in 2024. A girl whose last name was Scruggs took the silver, and then a Canadian girl took the bronze in women's foil. So in women's foil, North America took all three, which made me very happy because, you know, like I said, it's been over the years, it's been a sport completely dominated by the Europeans, but, you know, we've finally come to the forefront in fencing. But back to what I was originally saying, it's never been much of a spectator sport.
Gotcha. So we were kind of talking about this earlier, and so I'm curious, are you seeing, is there any kind of talk in changing things to bring in the people? So we talked about the lightsaber competitions and how that's gaining more popular. So I'm curious if there's things like the lightsaber or incorporating, you know, maybe in a kind of a crazy idea, grasp for ideas, incorporating, you know, some kind of MMA like element to fencing or something like that.
Not that I've heard of. As far as I know, it will continue to evolve, and that rules will continually change. And they changed the. There's an action called a flick, where I can, if I put the brakes on my, if I make a really high-handed attack, and I put the brakes on time, I can make my foil bend around. It'll do like almost 90 degrees, where I can hit you on top of your shoulder, or some people can flick it even cause it to hit you on the back. They changed the timing on the box, trying to eliminate the flick, because a lot of coaches complaining about it, because that's really, we got to go back and remember that the weapons we use were based on the duel. Okay. And from time immemorial, when fencing developed as a sport, it's always been about the duel. And now you got people who are really bending the rules, but with the flick, not only bending the blade, but bending the rules, because now instead of making a straight thrust to make a touch or a cut to make a touch, you are your blade's bending around and it's hitting somebody on the back. And if you did that in the duel, if I raised my hand and tried to flick and stop that blade with my hand high and get that blade to bend around in a real duel, number one, it probably wouldn't do that. Number two, I would be wide open and I'd get stabbed before I could even make it, even land the touch. So it didn't comply with the rules. It didn't comply with the idea of the duel. So they tried to eliminate that by changing the timing on the scoring boxes. So the tip of the weapon had to be depressed longer in order for, or the blade of the saber had to be on the target longer for it to score. And in saber, they don't really flick. It's mostly a foil problem. They changed it to saber for something else. I'll explain that in a minute. So they tried to change the timing so the tip had to stay depressed longer, but it didn't do anything. It didn't change anything. People could still flick and make the touch. What it did do was eliminate the novice flicker, the guy that would come out there and try to flick you on the back and ended up getting you flat across the shoulder. And at that point, that's the person you wanted to meet in the parking lot later, because it really hurt. Really hurts. But in Saber, they changed the timing of the box so the blade had to be pressed longer because of something called a flesh attack. Was that part of what they changed? They took away a flesh attack is basically I'm flying through the air. Flesh is French for arrow. Okay. So I'm flying through the air at my opponent. My feet are off the ground, and I am literally like an arrow flying through the air at my opponent with my point out. It's a super fast attack. It's still allowed in foil, but they took it out of saber because when they electrified saber, it got to the point where everybody fleshed. You hardly saw any defensive plays at all. It was mostly attack, attack, attack. And it was he who fleshed first always got the touch. So they changed the timing and they took the flesh out. You cannot crawl in your when you're making a fleshing action, your back foot crosses in front of the front foot. And they eliminated that. In Saber, the back foot could not cross in front of the front foot. When you're on guard, you're kind of in a very sideways position so that it's a less target area. And so you have your front foot from your dominant foot is forward, and that's dominant foot, dominant hand leads, and back foot, back hand stay out. And you're pushing off the back foot to make your lunge.
Gotcha.
Changes, as far as I know, that was the last real changes that were made that I'm aware of, unless they made some here just recently.
Very cool. Very cool. So, kind of changing gears here. So we had to talk the Princess Bride, the sword fight scene. Well, I guess there's a number of sword fighting scenes, but the pinnacle scene between Indigo and Wesley.
Excellent. So the best choreographed sword play I think I've ever seen. It was very good.
And
Very good.
was accurate with the kind of things they were talking about and stuff. Were those accurate terms and things that they were using, or?
Yeah, I'm sure there's some of the people where there's actually a group of HEMA, historical, I forget what it exactly stands for. The HEMA people do reenactments and they do tournaments too of historical weapons, historical fencing weapons, broadswords, rapiers. I think they do small sword too. They probably argue about that, but there's a li there's very a very limited source of knowledge on how historical fencing, how fencing would have been in the medieval ages and 1600s. A little more information is available. You get into the 1700s and stuff, and there was some There were some books that were written about fencing by fencing masters. So, you know, you get to that point and you had a little more knowledge about how it was done. But actually how there's a few books around and a few things, few things available on how medieval fighting would have progressed. And it was not just use sword play. There was a lot of grappling and fisticuffs and everything else involved in it. You know, if you could get, you got to remember that back then they were fighting to the death. And so, you know, if they could scratch your eyes out and accomplish the same thing, they were going to do it. So,
was there any movements or sequences that they maybe didn't do that you maybe would have wanted them to include or anything like that?
No, it was really, really good sword play in that. But the best, actually the best fencing scene was not involving any sword play at all. Do you remember the poison cup scenario?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Great scene.
Yeah. Well, that's it. That's fencing. That's modern fencing. Or that's probably fencing is probably karate too in a nutshell. I know that you know that I know that you know and back and forth. So I know you're going to make a certain action if I make a certain action. And you know that if I make that certain action, you're going to make another action. So it's a back and forth like that exchange, just like in that poison cup scenario. That to me, that's the essence of fencing right there. Yeah, because I know if I'm actually to an opponent that I know as I fence before and I'm aware how they fence. I know if I make a certain action, I can look for them to make a counter action. But they also know me and they know that if I make that, I'm going to make that action knowing that they're going to make an action. So they're probably going to try to do a different action. So it's a mind
game. Oh, yeah. I can definitely relate to that. As you were mentioning that, it just made me think about, so I recently started doing Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and in the class I was in recently, we were kind of working on our strategies, and while I'm grappling with these guys, I'm the whole time I'm thinking about, oh, well, I know that he can do this move, and in my limited set of moves, I can do this, but I know that if I do this, it's going to put me in a position to where he can get me with this. And I was just having that whole, oh, I know you know that I know that you know that. And so now every time I roll, I'm going to be thinking about that. So that may hurt my game. It may help it. I'm not really sure yet, but
try not to think about it when you're actually doing it. Think about it before you actually get out there and start fighting.
I know for sure it's going to change the way that I watch The Princess Bride.
You look at that, you're going to go, oh, holy moly. That's what we do. That's the perfect fencing scene. Perfect fencing scene.
So I'm curious, are you aware of any other movies or scenes that have particularly good example of fencing that you've come across?
I'm trying to think of the name. There's a movie that was done a number of years ago. Oh, God. And it was the one I was talking about earlier about in the Napoleonic period that had some of the best saber fencing I've ever seen. And there was a lot of fencing in that movie. God, I wish I could remember the name of it.
No worries. I got some homework to do then. So,
I'm trying to think of who the main character was, the actor. I can see the guys in my head. I can see the sword play, but I can't remember the name of the movie. Mm-hmm. Getting old as a.
Well, we got some homework. Actually, I'm kicking myself because I was actually going to send you a video clip from a Jackie Chan movie where there was a pretty significant fencing scene, and I meant to send you the clip. After we're done, I'll hunt down that link and I'll send it to you because I'm curious to get your thoughts on the fencing displays.
I think I've seen a couple of them, but I didn't see any. I don't remember any where there was any fencing. Mm-hmm. Now, right offhand, the only one I can think of is the one I can't remember the name of. That was really good save a play in that. And wait, there was one. Oh gosh.
Well, that's okay. We can figure it out, and I'll get it in the I'll get it put in the show notes when we figure it out later. I'm sure after we get done, it'll be like, oh yeah, that was that movie, and then yeah. So, but no worries there. But yeah, we'll definitely cover that on another time. Oh, go ahead.
If you're interested in learning more about swordplay and the history of it, a really good book was written by a British author. The name was By the Sword. And it's basically the whole history of swordplay from medieval times up till how it developed into a modern thing. And a lot of good stories in there about modern fencing and some of the international competitions and some of the interesting things that happened at some of them. It's a good book. Cohen's the name of the author.
Okay. Well, you'd add it to the list.
Yeah, it's great. By the Sword.
Very nice. Very nice. All right. So looking at the time here. Oh, go ahead.
I said fencing has a very long history. I mean, the first recorded really isn't a mention, but there's a cartouche on one of the pharaohs, I think it's Ramesses II's tomb, that actually shows a couple of guys fencing in front of the doing a fencing demonstration in front of the pharaoh. And they have on masks, kind of similar to what we wear nowadays. And obviously they have, it's by the shape of them, it looks like they're wooden swords that they're actually doing this demonstration with. So that's, yeah, that's pretty old. But you think about it, you know, the sword's been around a lot longer than the gun.
Yeah, for sure.
That's what, you know, that's the thing. Americans, the sport has never been all that popular here up until we started winning gold medals in the Olympics, and then suddenly started taking off. When I started, there was like 14 of us, I think, at the local club. And before COVID, I had over 100 fencing students. I had programs in like three or four. We had programs in like five private schools. And the kids would do competitions between each other, and then we would do team competitions at the end of the school year. We would do team competitions between all the schools, and we had these big trophies that if you won the competition, your school got the trophy and everything. They were traveling trophies. So it's become a lot more popular. COVID sort of wrecked that, though.
Yeah. And I really heard a lot of this.
Yeah, I messed up a lot of stuff. Certainly did.
Very nice. Yeah, no, I'm definitely gonna check more into it, and I'm not even sure if there's any fencing schools around in my area, but I'm definitely gonna take a look and see if I can.
In the bar?
I'm in the Dallas Fort Worth area. Actually, it just reminded me.
Yeah, there's some fencing schools around in that area. One of my former students who went to college. We've had a number of students go to school on weekends in NCAA on scholarships. Some of them are on scholarships. But Jay Thayer was one of our students at the club, and he did quite well. He when he graduated, I think he started a club down in San Antonio, which I think that's a pretty good way to Dallas.
Yeah, it's a few hours, but definitely going.
There's some fancy styles around in that area, for sure.
Yeah, it actually reminded me that so I used to live in Reno, Nevada, and when I got started in the art of capoeira out there, one of the guys that I was training with was a fencer, and I totally kind of forgot about that. So I'll have to look him up and see what he's been doing there.
And what were you training in?
Say again.
What was the style you were doing?
It is called capoeira. It's African Brazilian martial arts.
Interesting.
You know, dance fighting. Some people would say, but yeah, that's capoeira is my other core art. Kenpo and capoeira are my two kind of main martial arts loves. But I've dabbled in a number of other arts as well.
That's interesting. I'll have to do some research on that. Now you made me curious.
Very nice, very nice. You're the
things available for that.
There's schools and stuff all over. There's all kinds of stuff on YouTube. You're in Florida, is that correct?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Southwest Florida, Fort Myers.
Okay, I believe you're not too far from actually. A capoeira teacher that is part of the organization that I'm part of, so I'll definitely have to get you in touch with her, and you can learn some more about it. So
yeah, I'd like to check that out. Lee gave me a book some time back, and it was World History of Martial Arts, and I tried to read the whole thing, but there were too many words in it I couldn't pronounce.
Yeah, I'm still struggling with one of the reasons why I love Kenpo is that depending on the school, there's not a lot of Japanese and Chinese words that you have to stumble on. Most everything in the system is all in English and nice, easy English words to pronounce.
Yeah, this book had it was about martial arts all around the world, all the different styles. And there was one of them from Africa and stick fighting. And it was interesting. And I was afraid that because I'm not that fast of reader and I'm trying to figure out how to pronounce some of the words in it. And I'm like, well, by the time I get through this whole book, Lee and I both will be old and gray. And I think he probably sooner than that. So.
Yeah, well, I'm still kicking myself in that I actually have not finished reading Mr. Wedlake's book, Lessons with Ed Parker, yet. I'm so close. I'm almost done with it. And before, so I had him on the show a while back, and as we were talking before we recorded, I told him, oh, I'm going to have the book finished before we do our interview. And I didn't get it finished. And I said, well, I'm going to make sure I finish it right away. And I still haven't. So I guess I shouldn't tell myself, but you know, I did. But I swear I'm going to finish the book. And
I will. Lee and I sometimes get together for breakfast. He lives not too far from where I do.
Yeah, very nice, very nice. Yeah. So yeah, looking at the time, it's kind of funny because I just kind of realized that we actually didn't get into your personal story, but that's okay because this is my show, so I can do with it however I want. So we'll definitely have to get you back on into your specific story, but I just love hearing about the fencing and learning more about it. And it's getting me interested in more stuff that I need to check out. I don't have enough to do already.
Yeah, so far you can have me back on and we can talk about me. Oh, yeah. I'd much rather talk than general, but you know, my story is actually pretty.
Yeah, no, I actually heard your story on, so I'm going to give a shout out to the Everyday Martial Artist podcast. I've mentioned it on my show a few times, but Mr. Brian Doucette does an excellent show, and you were on it fairly recently as we're recording today. And so I highly recommend that y'all check out that show, and you can hear the story. But yeah, I'm definitely gonna have you on again to get into more stuff. But for right now, we're going to go ahead and move to our lightning round. I've got just a couple of little questions here, and then we'll kind of close out for today. First one being, if there was, well, I usually do this particular question as one, but I'm going to start breaking it up into two questions. So if there was anyone that you could train with, living or dead, who would that be? And the kind of second half of that question, the first part being, would be non-fictional characters. And the second part of that question would be fictional characters. So anyone, whether you've trained with them before or not, at any time, who would the real people be, and who would be the fictional people be?
Well, the real person would be Mac Garrett. Like I said, Mac and I were friends, and he passed away. I would give anything for Mac to be back. I never trained under Mac. Mac and I worked together. We did the national championships here in Fort Myers in 1993, and Mac was very instrumental in helping organize that. And he and I became good friends over the years, and I miss him terribly, and I would have loved to have had a chance to train under Mac. He was... from what I understand from people I know that did train under, is a very good instructor. Second part of the question,
Cyrano de Bergerac.
Oh, nice. Nice. I like that.
Yeah, not only was he fast with his sword, but he was fast with his wit. So, yeah, definitely Cyrano.
Very nice. I like it. All right, so now we are at the point for a shameless self-promotion, so you can plug anything you want or anything that you wanted to get out that maybe we hadn't mentioned. Now is your time to put that out there, and then we'll go ahead and close for today.
If you're into regular martial arts, taekwondo, whichever style, give fencing a shot. You might like it. I mean, Lee called me years ago and said, we would like for you to do a fencing demonstration for his students. And so we did. And that's how Lee and I became friends over the years. And eventually he started doing fencing. Because like I say, it is another style of martial art. And it's very fast. And it's a lot of fun to do. So, you might want to broaden your horizon and give it a shot. So. That's my shameless self-promotion.
Perfect. Yes, I will definitely check it out. And I will also suggest that the listeners do the same. So I thank you so much for taking the time to be on with me and talk some fencing. And
enjoy talking to you. Not only about fencing, I thought about karate too, taekwondo.
We'll definitely have to chat some more about that. And like I mentioned, I will get you. I need to find that a video clip, but I'm going to send that to you, and so get you in touch with the Capoeira people, and we'll grow our love of the arts together. So,
all right, sounds good, man. You have a good rest of your week.
All right, you too, and thank you again, and I will let you know when this is ready to go out.
All right, very good. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to My Empty Hands. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with a friend. If you didn't enjoy it, please share it with an enemy. If you'd like to be a guest, or if you would like to recommend a guest for the show, please email me at podcast@talkingkenpo.com. Thank you.